My name is Charlene, and I'm an alcoholic. Powerless over mood-changing drugs, sober by the grace of God, this fellowship, and because I came to believe. There's only about two things in this life that really threaten me. The first is one of the people I work with who's 7 feet tall, and the second is microphones. Now, this 7-foot-tall person that I work with, he does it on purpose, because he knows that I feel threatened. Anyway, I'm going to try and overcome it. Anyhow, I'd like to thank Joe for asking me to speak. This is something that I kind of enjoy doing most of the time. Every once in a while I get butterflies, but not too often. When I was new in the fellowship, I would always be very impressed with speakers, and my sponsor would say, someday you're going to be up there doing it, and I would tell her that she was out of her mind, that I was never going to be able to do this, and she'd say, after we invest enough time in you, you'll have a message to give to other people. And that's kind of how it worked for me. Enough time was invested to teach me a different way to live. When I was 16 years old, it was on New Year's Eve, and I was babysitting for some of my relatives, and they told me to help myself to the vodka. When I poured it out of the bottle, I replaced it with water. And when they came home and asked me if I had anything to drink, I said no as I staggered up the stairs. Now, I was off and running from that time to the day I came to the program. I grew up in a small town just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I didn't drink every day because my mother didn't allow her children to drink every day. I didn't grow up in a family where there was active alcoholism. There was alcohol in our home. It was brought out for weddings, christenings, events of that nature. And as I was growing up, I was I was grossly overweight. I tipped the scales at 180 pounds. And I was what they called back in those days as very shy. I know it today as extremely self-centered. I also felt like a jigsaw puzzle with several of the pieces missing. And when alcohol came into my life, they were the pieces in my life. Alcohol allowed me to function the way I thought other people functioned. Bearing in mind that I compared my insides to your outsides, I always came up with the short end of the stick, and alcohol filled in these gaps in my life. It allowed me to do act the way I thought normal, so-called normal people acted. Today I believe that normal is a statistic that doesn't exist. I don't know any normal people. Even ones that don't drink and have no association with alcohol, I don't really feel that they're normal. I work with some of them, and they're as strange as I am. Anyhow, in these early days of my alcoholism, I like I said, I didn't drink on a daily basis, but every chance I had to drink, I drank. And I drank to get drunk, and every time I got drunk, I felt guilty. I can remember trying to have a conversation with my parents after some sort of social function within the family, and sitting on the opposite side of the room from them so that they wouldn't smell my breath and so that I wouldn't get chewed out. I know a man in the program in Pittsburgh who says he's Irish Catholic and alcoholic, and that makes him double addicted, and so I'm not quite sure what that makes me, but I know that I belong. As I grew up in an Irish Catholic home, and early in my bringing up, it would always be, now that's not what nice Irish Catholic girls do. And that covered a multitude of sins. Anyway, in these early days, and especially after I met Dennis, and he asked me to marry him after we had had maybe 3 or 4 dates. And on the night he asked me to marry him, he took me out to a very nice supper club. He bought me a steak, and I had never had a steak before. And he bought me drinks with my meal and drinks after my meal. And I thought that that was what living was all about. I thought that when you got married, that it was just an endless round of these sort of things, that you went out for supper and you had drinks and everything was just wonderful. We were going to go off into the sunset, at least in my way of thinking. I had no idea that he had saved for 3 months for this one occasion. Even in the early days of my alcoholism, my feet were never firmly planted in reality. They were always somewhere else. And so after this courtship, we got married and we moved down to Southern Virginia. And being a member of a large family, I'm the oldest of five children. Even in that large family, there were times that I experienced loneliness. I think all alcoholics do. I think it's part of the illness. But after Dennis and I were married and we moved down to Southern Virginia, I experienced it in a way that I never did before. We lived in a very transient area, and even if I had been capable of making friends, which I seriously doubt, they weren't around long enough to make friends. And so in those early days, there was no drinking at all in my life, but I thought about it all the time. And when the doctors couldn't diagnose any particular physical illness for these severe pains I was having in my midsection, they prescribed these drugs. And the first time Dennis brought them home from the pharmacy, it said on the bottle, one every 4 hours. And I looked at that and I thought, if one is good, two is better. And from that day to the day I came to the program, the drugs were the poison of my choice, but I drank enough to qualify. Anyway, here I was, newly married and very lonely, in a condition known as pregnant, having another condition known as gallstones, at least that's what the doctors thought. And as the pregnancy continued, the other illness continued also. And sometimes these drugs weren't enough to control the pain. And so sometimes Dennis would take me over to the base hospital when it would get particularly severe, and they would shoot me full of Demerol. By the time I was 20 years old and going in to deliver our first child, I was down from this 150 pounds I was when Dennis married me to 120 pounds shortly before delivery. After this first child was born, I had my first set of DTs. I was given this child, and he had more heads than were necessary and more limbs than were necessary. And I was seeing things crawling on the nightstands. But I was afraid to tell anyone what was happening to me because I thought that they would lock me up and throw the key away. And years later, that proved to be true. When by the time we took this oldest boy up to Pittsburgh for my mother to care for while I had this surgery, I was in such bad shape by the time we got up there that Dennis took me to the hospital and they refused to release me. They kept me there, and they took my gallbladder out. When I came out of the anesthetic after the surgery, the doctor said to me, "Charlene, do you know you're pregnant again?" And I said, "I can't be. I just had a baby." And I thought, that since I had one, that God surely wouldn't send another one along. But I did nothing to prevent it. I was very naive in those days. And so during this, shortly after this, Dennis was discharged from the service and we moved back up to Pittsburgh. And during this second pregnancy, these medical problems continued, and it was in the days before the Controlled Substance Act was passed. And so these drugs that I had to have, I thought, in order to live, were readily available to me. All I had to do was call the pharmacy and say, "Fill prescription number so-and-so," and send it out, and they always did. I felt that in order to function the way I thought a good wife and mother should, I had to have these drugs. as my illness progressed, I got further and further away from reality, and so my ideas of what a good wife and mother were just there. If I thought about them today, you know, even without the drugs, I should have been committed somewhere, because I thought that a good wife and mother got up every morning and scrubbed the kitchen floor on her hands and knees, so that her children didn't get colds and the neighbors couldn't say, well, she'd scrub her floor on her hands and knees every morning at 5 a.m. her children wouldn't get colds. And so I did these things on a day-to-day basis. No wonder I had to have the drugs. I had to have them in order to function that way. I dressed our children in the summertime in short navy pants and in the wintertime in long navy pants. And they wore little white shirts with navy trim. And they wore little black Oxfords and little navy knee socks. And they always had a clean handkerchief in their pocket. And I cooked fresh every day from scratch. I baked everything from scratch. And I had the cleanest house in the suburbs in Pittsburgh. And I was so neurotic, it was unbelievable. Anyway, when the second son was a year old, Dennis was offered his job in Detroit, and we packed up and we moved there. And I pretty much liked it there. You know, there still wasn't a whole lot of money in the family. But what there was available to me, and I could get on a bus and go shopping or go to visit his grandmother or his aunts or uncles. And I pretty much enjoyed myself. The children, with all the hospital time I had, spent most of that in Pennsylvania with my mother, who potty trained them both and took them both off the bottle. And I thought that was just terrific, because she could do it better than I, because she raised five children and I only had two. And so I was in and out of these hospitals with various types of illnesses, like bleeding ulcers and various types of surgery. I had a hysterectomy when I was 26. And I was just in and out all the time. I was in the hospital more than I was out. And so, like Dennis said, the doctors after a while started to clamp down on these drugs, and it was precisely the way he put it, that one day he was coming home to a wife who was making an attempt to keep the children clean and the house cared for, and the next day was coming home to someone who was passed out on the floor. Dennis had encouraged a taste for good scotch in me. On one of our wedding anniversaries, he took me to Washington, D.C., and he ordered me a Rob Roy. And when I turned up my nose at it, he said, "You have to acquire a taste, Charlene." But the taste I acquired was not quite what he had in mind. So during these days when they clamped down on the drugs, I went back to the only other thing I knew, and that was alcohol. And since I already had this taste for nice scotch, I started off with that. And I wouldn't go to the store to buy it unless I could buy 3/5. I had a huge capacity and took great pride that I could drink any man under the table. I liked alcohol and I loved what it did for me. Anyway, during one of the subsequent wedding anniversaries, I think he took me to Washington for our 3rd anniversary, and for our 7th anniversary, I went out and bought him a bottle of this nice scotch that he encouraged me to drink. And for me, it's not insanity that an alcoholic drinks. It's what I did best for years. But when I went and got this scotch, I drank all but about 2 fingers of it. And then the insanity for me was that I wrapped it up and gave it to him for a present. And when he unwrapped it and he said, "But it's nearly all gone, Charlene," I said, "Well, I wouldn't want to give you bad scotch," and I had a taste of it. I must have left the cap off and it evaporated. I'm sure the evaporation rate in a fifth of scotch is not that high. Anyway, because it evaporated in about, maybe a couple hours. Anyway, so he swore then that there was never going to be an 8th anniversary. And this past June, we had our 20th, so it shows about the determination of an alcoholic. Anyhow, things got very bad while we were there, and as he told you, we packed up and we moved back to Pittsburgh. And this is where my alcoholism really took off. I got to get out of these shoes. The last time I spoke and my feet went to sleep, and it's happening again. I can't stand that. That's much better. I always think I need to wear those shoes because they go with the outfit and because I like to have a nice image. I like to think that I clean up nice. And God knows, I can't stand to leave them in the closet because I spent a fortune for the darn shoes. But I could only stand them for so long, you know. It's hard when my comfort gets interfered with. Almost anything in my life will go if it interferes enough. Anyway, when we moved back to Pennsylvania, we moved way out in the suburbs, and I was used to having some mobility. I didn't have a lot because of not having a license, but there was some. And my mobility was really restricted when we moved out there because there was no bus service. And I knew that he did this intentionally to me. And so I did something kind of in retaliation. I started to make the rounds of what I like to call the mentally bewildered wards. And on the east side of Pittsburgh, they have a hospital on one side of the street. It has four, maybe five floors of a hospital where women go to have babies and people who have heart problems, things of that nature. Right across the street from it, they have 12 floors of nothing but lunatics. And that's where they put me. Now, in the beginning, I liked it pretty much there. They put me up on the top floors. They gave me a private room with a private bath. I thought befitting a person of my stature and breeding. And they gave me a couple of series of shock treatments, but I never drank to be too aware. And so a little more confusion didn't really matter that much to me. After I was there for a while, they gave me a pass and told me that I could go out for walks. I had to be there to take medication. I had to be there to sleep. I was always there for medication. After a while, I soon learned that on one day I could walk in one direction to a drugstore and sign my name for codeine cough medicine. And on the days that I couldn't get that, I could walk in the other direction and encourage this taste for good scotch. And after I was there for another little while, one of the nurses on the floor, who's a member of the fellowship today, invited me over to her apartment. And here I was, 26 years old. I had led a very sheltered life. I was protected by my parents until my husband took over. And when I was invited over to this apartment, it was in a college neighborhood, and they were smoking marijuana. And I had never experienced that before. After a while, it got down very small. They were passing it around, and they wrapped it in a matchbook cover and said, "Drag real hard, Charlene." And I swallowed it. And that night, they took me. I went back to the hospital, and I said to the nurse, "I have a sore throat." And the nurse pulled out her flashlight and said, "Yeah, we'll have the doctor for you tomorrow." The next day, the doctor came by, and he looked at my throat, and he said, "You know, I just gave you a physical exam a couple of days ago, and there was nothing the matter with your throat. And today you have blisters on it." Well, I had two rules of thumb in those days. If I couldn't dazzle you with brilliance, I would confound you with bullshit. If I had any doubts as to what to do, I would mumble a great deal. Now, I don't know how I got out of that particular event, but I got out of it. In any event, things were continuing. They were going from bad to worse at home, after I would be released, you know, from the hospital, and I would go home, and I would maybe be there for a while until Dennis and I would really have a rip-roaring fight, and I would call the doctor and say, get me a bed. I'm packing a bag. I'm going to the hospital. Because I wouldn't put up with it. You know, I'd just leave and go back there. I liked it there real well. I didn't have any responsibilities. I didn't have a home or children or a husband to care for. I just did as I damn well pleased, you know. There was no, Dennis didn't try to control the money because I guess he thought that they wouldn't let me drink while I was confined in a mental institution. And so it was, he was very, very easy with the money. And I liked it real well. Responsibilities were never one of my all-time favorites. Anyhow, on one occasion I was released from the hospital on, you know, on a Thursday or Friday, and sometime that weekend our youngest boy fell behind these townhouses that we lived in, and he cut open his right arm. He severed both nerves and the artery and 15 tendons. I was passed out on the couch, and if Dennis hadn't have been there, he would have bled to death. And so as things like this started to happen, as they do in an alcoholic's life, I started to drink more and more, and I started to descend into what I know today as the hell that active alcoholism is. The more things like this happened, the more I drank, and the more I drank just for oblivion. I would drink until I passed out, and when I came to, I would drink again until I passed out. And as the alcoholism got worse, they started to move me down from the top floors in this hospital. They weren't putting me on the nice floors anymore. They started moving me down to the 8th and the 9th floor, and on either one of these floors, if you get off the elevator and stand at the nurse's station and look in either direction, you'll see a long marble hallway. And if you walk down these hallways, you'll see on either side of you gray steel doors. And if you get inside this first steel door, there's another one exactly like it, and they have bars on the windows in these doors. If you get inside the second one, you'll see another marble floor. Sometimes these rooms have windows in them and sometimes they don't. If they have a window, the windows have bars on the inside and the outside. And they have beds that match the gray steel doors. These beds are bolted to the floors, and sometimes they have sheets on them and sometimes they don't. But one of the things these beds always have on them are full restraints. And I started coming to in rooms like that. I started coming to in my own excrement, and I started coming to seeing things crawling on the walls, hearing things that I knew weren't there, and I started praying to die. I had my first suicide attempt when I was 13 years old, but it wasn't too serious because I wasn't too serious. And along this time, Dennis took a trip to Dayton to attend some classes and to receive an award for some work he had done. And I was in particularly bad shape. I had been sick for a couple of weeks. And at this point, I drank all the alcohol I had in the house, and I took all the narcotics I had in the house, and I went into an alcoholic coma. They hospitalized me in intensive care. I was in this coma for 3 days, and Dennis had to be called home from Dayton because they didn't know whether I was going to live or not. And so as the alcoholism got worse and I descended into it, I started to experience what I know today as the sickness of the soul. And dying started to look real good to me. I know people in the fellowship who believe that it takes a certain amount of courage to attempt suicide. I'm not a believer in that. I believe that suicide is the ultimate act of an extremely self-centered person. And I believe what I was saying was that I would, by God, no matter how much it costs me, deprive you of my presence. Eventually, we packed up and we moved down to the Washington, D.C. area. And I believed then, like I believe I'm here today, that things would be better. The only thing was that I failed to realize was that where I went, I took me with me. I was my own worst enemy. I would never allow anyone to treat me the way I treated myself. I'd kill someone before I'd let them. And so we went down there, and I traded one institution for another, one psychiatrist for another. The only thing that really drastically might have changed was that at this point I could have gotten my hands on the scotch that I thought I had to have. But by this time, I was so far gone into the illness that I couldn't keep the scotch down anymore. All I could keep down was cheap wine. And so the suicide attempts continued some more. I had been drinking around the clock by this time, and I came down with pancreatitis. I was taken to the hospital, and the doctors ran some tests and said that it was pancreatitis, and they asked me, did I drink? And I said, no, only socially. And they gave me morphine, which only took the edge off the pain. I was on intravenous for a couple of weeks. And when they released me from the hospital, they said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to be dead in 6 months. And I thought, my God, it's going to take that long. I had watched someone, a member of Dennis's family, die as a vegetable from alcoholism. And a terror that I lived with on a day-to-day basis was that I would go that way. I saw another young man who was a friend of our family's die, who chug-a-logged a fifth of tequila, but he just never came to. And I thought that if I could go the way Billy did, that would be okay with me. But I was terrified that I would go the other way. I couldn't stand thinking about it. It tore my guts up, and I couldn't bear it sober, and I couldn't bear it drunk. And no matter how much I drank, unless I passed out, I couldn't get it out of my mind. I had one last suicide attempt. I took a trip to the drugstore. I bought Safety Edge razor blades. And I came home and I took all the narcotics and all the barbiturates, because by this time I was hooked on them too. And I drank all the alcohol that I had in the house. I filled the bathtub full of water, and I got in and I started cutting on myself. And I thought, if the pills and the booze don't kill me and I don't bleed to death, maybe I'll drown. And one more time I was found. And one more time I was patched up. And one more time I was sent home. And one more time the doctors were astonished that I was still alive, because it was not my intention to be alive. About 9 years ago, this next month, I had begged Dennis for some help, and he didn't know what to do for me. And I asked him to take me to the psychiatrist, and I begged him to lock me up and not let me out until I didn't want to drink anymore. So he put me, for the first time to my recollection, in a detox unit. But after I was through the detox, I was put on the psychiatric side, and they gave me a pass, and I went out and drank some more there. But while I was in the detox unit, they brought meetings in. And I met a woman there who gave me her name and her phone number and said, if you ever want to go to some more meetings, when you get out of here, give me a call. Around Christmas time, I was released from the hospital, and of course, I never called her. And sometime the following month, one Wednesday morning, I came to. And for the first time in my almost adult life, I decided that day that I was going to try not to drink. And so I walked over to this meeting that I had heard about. I put on the clothes that I had probably been wearing since I was released from the hospital. And I walked over, and this woman that I had met in a detox unit was there. I had quit bathing. I had quit brushing my teeth. I had quit washing my hair. I was covered with wine sores. And after the meeting, she came over and put her arm around me and told me she was glad to see me. And it had been a long time since anyone said that to me. And she asked me, did I want to go to some more meetings? And when I said, yes, I did, she told me that she would come by to get me that night. She didn't wait for me to call her. And so she carried me around to meetings for about a week or 10 days. And I took my bottle with me. I had been treated for seizures for years. I was on Dilantin and Phenobarb. But as long as I drank, I continued with the seizures. They only got worse. I would take my bottle to the meetings, and I would have seizures in the ladies' rooms, and they would haul me off to Alexandria Emergency Room. And Dennis, who thought that I would be okay because you good people from AA had hold of me now, would come and have to pick me up at the emergency room. And eventually, after a week or 10 days of hauling me around this way, she said to me, you know, Charlene, you can't get sober unless you quit drinking. Nobody had ever told me that before. You know, the simplest things eluded me. Anyway, I told her, for the first time in my life, I was honest with someone, and I told her that I couldn't, that I had tried to quit drinking and I couldn't. And so arrangements were made for me. I was taken to Washington Hospital Center, and from there I went to Seneca. That was the treatment facility that Dennis was telling you about. And from there, I went to Adam's house. It was a women's halfway house in Rockville, Maryland. I remember when I went to Seneca that I still had these sores on me, and I didn't hardly eat, and I didn't sleep, and sometimes I scratched until I bled. But even after being there for almost a month, I liked it. I didn't have anything else except the abstinence from alcohol and drugs. But I had never had that my whole life for that long a period. And when I found out that I could go, or that there was a halfway house, it was somewhere written, I think, in my heart and soul, that this was it for me, that there wasn't another chance. And so I asked if I could go, and I packed up and I went there. And I loved it. I lived there for about 7 months. It was my home. I was 31 years old when I came to the doors of the program. I was bankrupt in all areas. I had nothing more going for me except I didn't want to be the way I was, but I had no idea how to go about changing. The first time I went to a meeting and admitted that I was an alcoholic, it was a step up for me. Even though I thought that I couldn't get well in these meetings, I knew that being alcoholic was a good thing. This life, that my life had become such a burden that to have a name for what was the matter with me was very soothing to me. I started to work, and I started to pay room and board. I remember every Friday I would get my check at work, and I would go home and I would pay this $40 room and board. And I loved doing it. It was the first time in my life that I acted responsible for myself. My parents had been responsible for me, and Dennis had been responsible for me. And now at last I was starting to be responsible for myself. The woman that ran the halfway house became my sponsor. And she would say to me, stand up straight, ride tall on the saddle. You're one of the king's kids, and there's nobody better than you. And the fact that I was one of the king's kids and I was an alcoholic kept me glued together. That, and she would give me gold stars from time to time, but that kept me glued together for the first couple of years, because that's how long it took for me to come out of the fog. She used to... One of the things that used to distress me greatly was that I couldn't remember things that I would hear in the meetings, and I would hear people talking about taking these things with you outside of the meetings, and when you had a problem, you could draw on them and use them. It was to be a different way of life, but I couldn't remember any of them. And so one day I went to the drugstore, and I was very pleased with myself with doing this. I went to the drugstore and bought a notebook to write things down in. And I took it home from her to her like a first grader takes home his first paper with a star on it. And I showed it to her, and I told her why I bought it and what I was going to do with it, that I was going to write these things down that I would hear in meetings, and then when I was away from home and away from the meetings and I had a problem, I could open my notebook and look at these things, and they would help me. And she went like this: "There's a gold star for you, sweetheart." And I loved those stars. Eventually, I went home to live with Dennis and the boys. And when I had about a year in the program, my financial insecurity reared its ugly head. And I, in those days, I thought of Dennis as my chief defective character. And I thought what I was doing was trying to remove him. I had a butcher knife, and he wasn't going to take that checkbook and that money and leave me stranded. I would kill him before I'd let him do that. Anyway, when I had 2 years in the program, he gave me, I don't have it on today, but I have some jewelry that he bought for me. It's a little gold star for my throat and some stars for my ears, and I have a ring also. And when he gave it to me, the jewelry is very precious to me, but when he gave me the jewelry, he said, "Because you're my gold star wife." And those words mean more to me than the jewelry does. When I was recovering, when I was newly recovering and in the halfway house, my sponsor used to talk to me about emotional sobriety. It's promised us in the seventh step. And she would say to me, "You too can learn to live at peace with God as you understand Him, your fellow human beings, yourself, and Dennis too." Now, it never even occurred to me my whole life that it was any way, shape, or form part of my responsibility to live at peace with Dennis. As a matter of fact, I thought exactly the opposite. But after a while, when she would say these things to me, I would like what she was saying, and I would ask her, "How long is this going to take?" And she'd say to me, "How long it takes is how long it takes, and how rough it gets is how rough it gets, but by God, you don't have to die drunk today." Well, on Sunday mornings, I used to like to do this thing. I used to like to cook her breakfast on Sunday morning. And all this time I'd be cooking her breakfast, and I'd be at her about how long it was going to take for this emotional sobriety. And every Sunday morning I would ask her, "How would you like your eggs today?" And she would say, "With the yolks runny and the white solid." And what she got didn't hardly resemble eggs. And so this one Sunday morning I'm at her about this emotional sobriety, and she said to me, "When you can cook eggs with the yolks runny and the white solid, you'll have emotional sobriety." Now, I believed her literally what she would say to me. And so I drove myself around the bend with that one for a while. And finally, I gave up and I started to scramble the eggs. And when I went home to live with Dennis and the boys, I used to ask Dennis how he liked his eggs. And he liked them the same way she did, but what he got didn't hardly resemble eggs. And so finally, after about 2 years in the program, it was over 2 years, one Sunday morning I cooked his eggs with the yolks runny and the white solid, and she was out of town. Now, I didn't talk to other people. I had the obligatory notebook that you write everyone's phone numbers down in, but I wouldn't talk to other people. If anyone asked me how I was, I would tell them, "Ask Marge." And so I just didn't. Anyway, on this particular Sunday morning, I was dying to tell her that I cooked eggs with the yolks runny and the white solid, and so I had emotional sobriety. And I just didn't know what to do. I didn't have her number where she was in Pennsylvania, and so I got out this notebook this obligatory notebook that everyone has, and I start calling up these people, and I would say, "Hi there, this is Charlene, and I cooked eggs with the yolks running and the white solid this morning." And these people would say to me, "Oh, that's real good, honey." Now, my first couple of years, I sat around meetings and drooled on myself. Most people thought that I was either still on drugs or I had drank myself into a wet brain. And so when Marge came back to town, they said to her, "Oh, that new one of yours. You ought to heard what she did over the weekend." And they would start telling her, and a couple of them said to her, "What the hell's the matter with that girl? Is she still on drugs?" And Marge would say, "Oh, hell no, she's just sicker than most. But just watch her. She's getting better. She'll come out of it any day now." Well, anyway, you know, things were progressing along, and there were times that you couldn't hardly tell the difference between me and a reasonable adult. And Dennis and I started to get along well. I remember the first conference we ever went to. We rode 7 hours in the car, and I was so excited by the time we got there. I jumped out of the car practically before he had the motor turned off. I was jumping up and down on the ground, and there was Marge and I screaming at her. We rode 7 hours, and we didn't fight not one time. I would get so excited about things like this because little by little I was starting to see the program work in our lives. And the most, you know, I really was never too aware except when she would tell me about areas that I would be getting better in. But I was, I started to become aware of areas that Dennis was getting better in. And I remember one time saying to her, because this was maybe about a year, maybe more than that, I don't exactly remember, but I had never used the word love in connection with Dennis since I was new in the program. And I remember one time saying to her, "Maybe I can love him." And she said, and I said to her, "But I hate that word." And she said, "Well, why don't you use it until a better one comes along?" And I would call her every day, and she would say to me, "Do you love Dennis more today?" And some days I would, and some days I wouldn't. Some days I would think of him as being less than adorable. And some days I would think of him as, "Well, you're not going to get your shrine today." Anyhow, things were progressing, and we were, the four of us, getting better. And we packed up and we moved to Dayton, and I thought I would die. I just absolutely thought I would die when I came there. I felt absolutely convinced that I was never, ever going to have another friend again. I was not projecting. I was facing facts. This was the way it was going to be the rest of my life. My mother was in very bad shape, and in these early days in Dayton, I was trying to fit in, and I was having a hard time making friends with other women. But there were so many trips between Dayton and Pittsburgh that most of my time was consumed with what was going on there. Even when we weren't traveling there, there were so many phone calls that I felt that if we didn't bury my mother soon, that we would bury my father watching her die. And I felt like I was going down the tubes watching it all happen. And so eventually what happened was that we buried her on Christmas Eve. It was a beautiful thing, too. It was, the church was decorated the way it always is at Christmas time. It was my mother's favorite time of the year. A priest in the fellowship had the mass of Christian burial, and it was like sitting in a meeting. I remember after that, after we came from the cemetery, that there was a gathering of the family, and there was a lot of drinking, and there was a lot of reference to me being in AA, and didn't I want to have a drink, and didn't I want to do this. I remember Dennis taking me to a gathering of AA and Al-Anon people. I remember that night when I went back to my parents' home that I was crying, and I felt very sad that my mother was dead. I felt very grateful that I had made my amends to her, I felt very, very full of gratitude that when she died, I was at peace with it, that there was no more guilt in me, and that I had no knots in my guts over her death because I was at peace with her. Anyway, that night when there were tears, when I felt bad because she was my mother also, my sister said that I couldn't do that because I was alcoholic, and they all turned me away. And when I needed someone to cry on a shoulder, Dennis was there for me. Dennis was the one that held me till I cried myself to sleep that night. And Dennis is the one that's always there with me. I have a higher power that I enjoy a fantastic relationship with today. The fellowship and my higher power are my greatest blessings. But Dennis is my greatest blessing also. The three of them are all bunched in there together. The man that I thought I could never learn to live with, the man who I thought it was my responsibility to torment to the end of his living days, is one of the greatest blessings I have in my life today. There have been times that there are tears in my life again. They don't happen so much anymore, but in the beginning when I was discovering that our youngest son was following in my footsteps, there were tears then. And Dennis was the one who held me. Dennis was the one who comforted me. And Dennis is the one who steadies me in my life, along with my higher power. I have a relationship with God and my fellow human beings and my spouse today that gives me happiness in my heart and joy in my soul. It talks about, in the 12th step, joy is the theme of that step. And today I have those blessings. I have the blessings from working the steps of the program and from growing up in it. The fellowship has given me a way of life to replace a way of life, complete with a set of directions on exactly how to live it. I no longer have to think, I only have to do. Today, I have sometimes bad moments, but I don't have bad days anymore. I can have a bad moment that I can nurse the hell out of, but I no longer have bad days. I enjoy my life today. I started to work about a year and a half ago, and we acquired an old beat-up house that was neat and tidy on the inside, but kind of run down neat and tidy outside, but kind of run down on the inside. Kind of the way I was when I came to the program. And a little bit at a time, we're cleaning it up, just the way the program's done for us. Today, I enjoy my job. I have one that I'm glad to get up in the morning to go to. Some days it's not a real easy job, and I have to work real hard. But I've gone to school some in the last couple of years. I went to learn minor plumbing repair, and just recently I finished a course in basic house wiring. And I like to do those sort of things, you know. Like Dennis, service is my thing also. There was a time in my life when I was drinking that I thought if you wrote a check, you added the amount to what you already had in the balance. And there was a time that I thought that as long as you had checks, you weren't out of money. And so today I am area treasurer. And I explained all these things to these people when they approached me about doing it, and still, you know, I wonder about them. They're alcoholic too. You know, my life is something that I really enjoy living. It's, you know, I'm glad to wake up in the morning. When I was young and we were going out the door, my father would say to us, "May God hold you in the hollow of his hand until we meet again." I never knew until I came to the fellowship that that's exactly what he did. God bless you.